You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Along with Amos, who we heard from last week, Micah is one of what's called the minor prophets. Not because he's less important, but because it's one of a collection of a dozen shorter books that weren't Isaiah or Jeremiah. Much of what we know today as Micah was probably written 800 years before Jesus' life. The familiar passage we're hearing this morning is part of an extended rant against the politics, economics, and religious practices of Micah's day. Judean society had slid into an arrangement that unjustly favored the rich, who then added insult to injury by lording their privilege over the poor in ostentatious worship and conspicuous consumption. Micah basically says, cut it out or else. Overall, Micah's prophecy is a rhythm between judgment and hope, judgment and hope. And the passage we hear today is one that many people, including me, point to as not just a favorite verse, but as a summary of the whole of Judeo-Christianity.
Our words of wisdom are from Micah, chapter 6, verse 8.
And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God?
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Supreme Court Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes had the reputation of being absent-minded. One day, he was studying a pending case while on a train headed out of Washington. The conductor paused at his row and asked for his ticket. Nervously, the jurist searched each pocket, but to no avail. The conductor said, "Don't be concerned, Justice Holmes. We know who you are. When you return to Washington, you can send us the ticket at your convenience." Holmes lowered his eyes and shook his head sadly. "Thank you, my good man, but you don't seem to understand the problem. It's not a question of whether I'll pay the fare. The problem is, where am I going?" That's a good question for all of us to ask. One of my spiritual directors used to say that there are really only two questions a person of a spiritual bent needs answered. Where am I? And what time is it? And there's really only one way to answer those two questions, here and now. But where am I going is a close second. It's a question worth asking of ourselves as individuals and as communities and institutions. Where are we going? Our country is in the thick of asking that question. We have a former president claiming to be the rightful president and his followers calling for a violent military coup. Members of our own state legislature have lost their grip on reality and are doubling down on the legitimacy of a clearly unhinged and partisan election audit stunt. The United Methodist Church is in the throes of wrestling with not just where are we going, but in mapping out ways we can most effectively embarrass ourselves while we blow up the whole enterprise. And as we discussed last week, religion itself would do well to answer the question, where are we going? Last Sunday, we considered German theologian and martyr Dietrich Bonhoeffer's question of, what does religion even mean anymore? He wondered what a religionless Christianity would look like. A Christianity stripped of all the trappings we're used to. And when Bonhoeffer asked of religion, where are you going? He concluded that to get anywhere positive, religion needed to be reduced to just two elements, righteous action and contemplative prayer. Okay, you ask, so what does that look like? Well, let's look at action, then contemplative prayer, then the glue that holds the two together. Number one, action. Compassionate, righteous action usually takes one of three distinct forms: charity, service, and justice. Where charity involves gifts of money, clothing, food, or other material goods, it doesn't necessarily involve the investment of a person's time and talents. And where charitable giving demonstrates a person's generous nature, the giver often remains distant from those being helped. Service, on the other hand, involves face-to-face engagement with those in need. It can be transformative. It can change the lives of not only those who are being served, but those who are doing the serving. So charity and service are both personal forms of compassionate action. Their objective is to alleviate the effects of suffering in the world. Justice, on the other hand, seeks to eliminate the root causes of suffering, of transforming the social structures and systems that produce poverty and suffering. Charity and service seek to heal wounds. Justice seeks to transform the social structures that created wounded people in the first place. In church, it's usually easier to talk about charity than justice. John Dominic Crossan once said, "Charity gets you canonized, justice gets you crucified." Why? Because charity is often more of a short-term action that responds to an immediate, superficial need and gets immediate praise. Justice, however, is a harder slog. It gets us squarely into politics, where we come face-to-face with long-entrenched prejudices and the status quo of the domination system we live in. Plus, it's just more complicated than charity. If a child is hungry, feed them. It's simple. But if you ask how to change the system so there are no more hungry children, you've got as many different opinions as there are people in the conversation. So that's where the other side of the equation comes in. Number two is contemplative prayer. As we mentioned last week, Jesus continually withdrew from people, from daily life activities and the demands of his ministry to be alone. And what did he do? Well, nobody knows because no one was out there with him. But while the Bible says he prayed, it also says he wanted to be alone. And Jesus' solitude and the silence that usually goes along with being alone is how Jesus began his ministry. It's how he made important decisions. And it's how he dealt with troubling emotions like grief. It's how he dealt with the constant demands of his ministry and cared for his own soul. It's how he taught his disciples. It's how he prepared for important ministry events. It's how he prepared for his own death. So if Jesus is our guide, then quiet, contemplative silence seems to be just as important as action. I suspect if we look closely at what Jesus was doing, it would be similar to what we call meditation today. And the benefits of meditation as a spiritual discipline have been proven to help people reduce stress, remain calm, and be less likely to obsess over all the craziness in the world. One of my spiritual mentors, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, says that he finds that meditation helps him gain distance from his desire for control and power and helps him see more clearly the ways he can act in the world with justice and compassion. So call it what you will, meditation, contemplative prayer, or silence. It's not an escape. It's a vehicle for heightening our sense of connection with and compassion for all of life, stirring within us a desire to be a part of perfecting the world through love and justice. So here are our tools. Number one, action. And number two, contemplation. And the third element, the glue that holds it all together, community. The environment in which we mature as individuals and as a species, community. The check and balance on destructive or misguided ideas and behavior, community. Bottom line, you can't do this alone. Whatever religionless Christianity might look like in the future, it's still going to have to include community. About 25 years ago, I had the privilege of being on retreat with Father Richard Rohr in Albuquerque. I was the lone Methodist among nearly 100 Roman Catholics. It was an amazing experience. In naming his base of operations in New Mexico, it's clear that Father Rohr has taken Bonhoeffer's convictions seriously. He's called it the Center for Action and Contemplation, and it exists to serve as a foundation from which individuals can practice the model of spirituality that Jesus himself practiced. Action, then contemplation, then action again, then contemplation. But that alternation between action and contemplation is done in intentional community, with accountability, reflection, listening, the adjusting of one's expectations, and the curbing of prejudices along the way. Robert Fulghum tells the story of a young pastor who found himself in charge of some very energetic children. In an effort to corral some of that energy, he decided to lead them in a game called Giants, Wizards, and Elves. He gathered the kids into two groups and said, "Okay, the first thing your group needs to do is decide whether you're going to be giants, wizards, or elves." At that, a diminutive little girl tugged on the pastor's pant leg and asked, "But where do the mermaids stand?" The pastor told her, "There are no mermaids." And she chimed in pointedly, "Oh, yes, there are. I'm a mermaid." This precocious little girl knew what she was, and she wasn't about to give up on either her identity or the game. She intended to take her place, whether mermaids fit into the scheme of things or not. And that kind of thing only happens in community. Action, reaction, contemplation, different action. Requires effort to learn about and respect differences, to be compassionate with one another, to love and accept one another unconditionally, and to make allowances for doing things in ways you never have before. So, if we're going to live into God's conspiracy of love, we need to be honest and admit that religion, as it's understood today, may be more of an obstacle than a benefit. A lot of otherwise good people have been hoodwinked by toxic religious traditions that exclude people, deny science, and promote dangerous nationalist ideologies that allow for crazy cult-like movements like QAnon to hijack people's brains. So where are we going? I'd like to think we're moving forward, bending that moral arc of the universe toward justice. So with Bonhoeffer and Jesus, I think we need to take on the practice of action, contemplation, and renewed commitment to genuine community. As American Christians, we have to break free from this delusion that we can do it on our own, and that Jesus died for me, just me, so that I can go to heaven, woohoo! And start thinking about other people for a change. We need to figure out how we can do for the entire human family what we would do within our own individual families. In Living the Questions Jesus Fatwa series, one of our contributors, Nasser Ahmad, says, "You know, Ben Franklin said, 'God helps those who help themselves.' But Islam says, 'God helps those who help others.' I think society would be a much better place if we prioritized helping each other rather than just helping ourselves. As followers of Jesus, we need to take action, balance it with thoughtful consideration, and figure out how to live together as a human community, how to love one another, and how to care for all of creation. Acts of compassion, generosity, charity, service, and doing justice will not only help others, but transform us into better people." Although it's probably an apocryphal saying, Gandhi is attributed with having said, "Be the change that you wish to see in the world." Be the change. Take action. Take time for contemplative consideration of the way the world is. Be committed to a community that challenges you, even if it means including mermaids. You know, the theme of that New Mexico retreat I was on with Richard Rohr was community. What is it? How do you achieve it, enhance it, and grow from participation in it? The week-long retreat was to culminate in a Roman Catholic Mass led by Father Richard. And after all the talk of inclusivity and the unconditional acceptance of true community, that prospect posed a bit of a problem. As a non-Roman Catholic, I was simply not allowed to receive communion. My small group was actively considering sitting out the Mass in solidarity with me, but I was able to convince them that it was okay. It wouldn't be the first communion I was excluded from. That's just the way it is. So there I was, that one Methodist sitting in the back, while 100 Roman Catholics went forward to receive the elements from our mentor and leader. And then it happened. Father Richard started scanning the crowd. He looked up one line and down the other, and then his gaze fell upon me sitting in the back. He got this stern look on his face, pointed at me and mouthed, "Get up here." I waved as if to say, don't worry about it. But he got even more adamant and motioned for me to come forward to communion. I have to say that there are few times that I can remember ever being so humbled. And when I turned around and saw the crowd, few times I've ever seen more people beaming with approval and smiles. As it turned out, whether planned or not, I ended up being the object lesson that made all the week's talk about community real. Father Richard took action. He broke the rules of his religion to include me, because he knew that's what Jesus would have done. I was the mermaid that day, and I didn't even know it. So, where exactly are we going? I may not know the destination, but Micah tells us that along the way, we're to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with our God. And if we can do that, I think we have a chance to be a part of creating that better world we all know is possible. If we live our lives as co-conspirators with Jesus in action and contemplation, then there's a good chance we'll manage to keep the craziness at bay and, wherever we end up, be able to live into the vision Jesus has set before us. So be well and keep an eye out, mermaids.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.